We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com.
There are two sides to the question of the men hurt. There's the side of men hurting others, and there's the side of men being hurt. And our organisers tonight have asked Peter and I to speak on either side of this question and really have typecast us very well, Peter the one who hurts and I the one who am hurt. I thought it pictured our personalities perfectly there. It reminded me of the masochist, really, and the sadist. You know, the masochist is standing in front of the sadist saying, "Whip me, whip me, whip me." And the sadist says, "No." It's a lovely image, that was one of those ones that you, the more you think about it, the worse it gets, really. So stop thinking about it now. Well, do people hurt? Do men hurt? Are men given to being hurt? Or is the sensitive New Age guy teaching us that we're supposed to hurt when in fact we don't really? Well, let me deal with that question first, whether men hurt, by hurting all of you, just for a moment. A vicarious hurt, this one is, a kind of a hurt by sympathy, like that one's hurting my eyes. I can't see a thing now, especially my notes, and without notes I can speak for a long period of time. Thank you. Good. A vicarious little hurt that I may give you. Comes from our church, really. It's a true story. There's a little boy in our church, about 4 years old, who's had a series of infections, and so last week went to the doctor and was circumcised. Oh, that hurts, doesn't it? Several stitches he had in his circumcision. Even his grandmother said it would have been better if it was done when he was 8 days old. Just the idea. Do men hurt? Yeah, of course we do. It really does hurt, doesn't it? Every man I've told the story to has said, "Oh." Every woman has thought, "Oh, well, we have our problems too." There are two reactions to hurt. I tried to work out how to describe them, and I don't mean to be rude to anybody who doesn't follow the noble art of cricket and follows another game, but there are two reactions that I know that you can see to hurt. There is the soccer reaction and there is the cricket reaction. We're doing better in India, I hear. Last I heard was none for 55 in the last innings. We got them out for 165 and we have to get 187. And given how we've been doing so far in that cricket tour, I think we've got Buckley's. But never mind, we're none for 55. We may do it this time. You know, wonders may see. Well, anyway, there's the soccer reaction and the cricket reaction. Because in both games you can get injured. What do you do when you get injured in soccer? Well, you must make the most of it, mustn't you? Scream, yell, lie around the ground crying in agony, because you've got to get the ref to see that you've been properly fouled and wrecked, and so that you can get a penalty at least. And there's a remarkable kind of age of miracle recovery rate for soccer players, I've noticed, just after the referee has blown his whistle, because every inch of pain is expressed to the full on the soccer field when injured. Whereas when you get a fast ball under the ribs from a bowler, then what you've got to do is look down the wicket at him and kind of just show that glimmer of, "Why don't you get a cricket ball instead of a tennis ball?" kind of attitude. The last thing you can do is give any indication that there is a slightest flicker of agony coming from the three broken ribs and the internal hemorrhaging that even you can feel. There is nothing. You just walk down the pitch and flick a bit of grass off and walk back and chew as you wait for the next ball. and count to 10 desperately inside. Now, both those reactions to pain, to hurting, are found in the Bible, without reference to soccer or cricket. There is the soccer reaction to pain that you can see in the Bible. You can see people express their hurt. There's all kinds of men through the pages of the Bible who at different times express the hurt that they're having in tears, in crying. They're much a group of educated people here. Why don't you just turn to the fellows beside you either way and try and work out any story you can dredge up from your memory about anything about the Bible, of anybody actually ever crying in the Bible. Any men who are hurt in the Bible, and express it. Give you 2 minutes, just talk to the person beside you. Okay, how do we go? Who can tell me, who can just call out for us quickly, anybody who you can remember crying in the Bible, hurt in the Bible, right at the back there? Jesus wept at the graveside of his friend Lazarus. His mother wept, yeah?
Peter, after
he realised he'd denied Jesus 3 times. Yep. Samuel's mother was crying. She was in great pain, being childless. Yes, a great pain it is, childlessness, isn't it?
King David after committing adultery with Bathsheba,
yes. You don't have to laugh. He was crying, yes, okay. The repentance when Nathan points the finger at him, yes. Yes, David wept for Absalom. Oh, my son, Absalom, my son. I mean, hardly anybody can inflict so much pain on you as a foolish son, as a rebellious son like Absalom inflicted upon his son. I died instead of you, yeah? Yes, the parting of friends can lead to great crying and so on. And the Ephesian elders, when they said goodbye to Paul, Paul said he'd never see them again, and they wept mainly because they'd never see their friend again. Yes, somebody beside the waters of Babylon. Psalm 137, down by... You see, they were caught up by the Babylonian Empire, taken into captivity and made slaves in Babylon. And the people in Babylon, when they were there, they had all these local Jewish slaves in. They said, hey, sing us some of those Jewish songs. Sing us songs about Jerusalem. I said, how can we sing the songs of Jerusalem, the songs of the promised Holy Land, when we're in slavery and bondage in Babylon? So by the waters of Babylon we sat down and we wept. It's a wonderful psalm.
Jacob
over Joseph. Yeah, there you go for again. More children. And the grief of losing a child. Any of you lose a child? The hurt's awful, isn't it? Not having children when you want them, the hurt's awful. Having children and losing them, the hurt's awful. Having children who rise up to be Nabals, who rise up to be fools, who rise up to be rebellious and wayward and stupid, and that's awful, isn't it? Kids can give incredible pain to you. In fact, life does, doesn't it? And the Bible carries all this kind of hurt. Pick up the first one we heard. Jesus had this friend Lazarus, who died. Jesus knew he was going to raise him from the dead, but yet, face to face with death, Jesus, who had the power over death, still wept. He cried. Because death is awful. Death is a dreadful thing. It breaks our very heart and our relationships. And we see grown men cry. There's all kinds of those things, aren't there? I spoke to an old digger who'd who'd bottled that up for years, from the time of the Second World War until the Veteran Affairs had come to him to talk about getting a pension for some of the disabilities he'd caused by his war record and what had happened in the war. And so the social worker just asked him, what did he do in the war? And it was very interesting, because he was one of those men who came back and said, it's over, I don't want to talk about it. Just left it behind. As though for the first time in 40, 50 years, he said what he did in the war. And a man who didn't cry for 40 odd years, just broke down and sobbed and sobbed. Sobbed and sobbed over the mates who had died. Sobbed and sobbed over the fact that it wasn't fair that he didn't die. They'd gone, they'd been friends, they'd lived with each other, they'd slept with each other, they'd been everything to each other. One lived, one died because the bomb fell in this hole and not that hole. And he could never cope with it. Men hurt. I spoke in a church in Bloomington, Indiana, at a graduation service for the university there. A man hadn't been to church since the Vietnam War. He came in, and because his son was graduating, he couldn't not come to church because his son was graduating. But he couldn't stand being in church, because he said, and I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with him here, but this just telling what he's saying. He said he knew the war was wrong and that he shouldn't go, but he didn't have the guts to stay behind. But he thought it didn't matter because he wouldn't have to do anything there. But he said, I did. He said, I had to kill people with my own hands. And he says, I can't live with the murder on my own heart. And he couldn't tell anybody. He couldn't go and hand himself into the police as a murderer because he only did what soldiers do. But he couldn't face God because he knew he had killed wrongfully. Oh, men hurt. And men like he, like the old digger, like those who mourn their children, like those who mourn, join with Jesus in crying at times. But there is also the cricket reaction in the Bible. It's not as common, but it's there. A bit harder to see it. You can see it in Absalom. His sister was raped by his brother. Big, confused family. Absalom didn't do anything about it. We read he never said a word, either good or bad. But he hated Ammon because he had disgraced his sister Tamar. He just bottled it up. And it was a key part in the rebellion that led to nearly the destruction of his father's family and his father. But you see it in others. Daniel, Moses, here they are, men held in captivity, foreign countries, and yet they stood up for the truth. They didn't wilt under pressure, didn't cry. They acted rightly. And you see it in Jesus. For Jesus wept, but also Jesus refused to show emotion when it came to his own death. We read when he came before the chief priests of the Jews at a kind of kangaroo court in the middle of the night, we read, Jesus remained silent, gave no answer. And the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One? Gives no answers. Not going to be pushed around by authorities. He comes before Pilate. Pilate says, where do you come from? Jesus gave him no answer. Do you refuse to speak to me, Pilate said? Don't you realize I have the power either to free you or to crucify you? Jesus is not rattled by these men in this situation. He knows he's about to be killed. He's face to face with the men who have the power to kill him or to release him. He doesn't cave in. Doesn't scream, doesn't yell, doesn't answer, doesn't insult, doesn't hurt, doesn't scream, doesn't, just refuses. We read, he committed no sin, no deceit was in his mouth. When they hurled insults at him, he didn't retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. He entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He just trusted God in the situation. Why? Why is there this cricket reaction to hurt? Well, in cricket, you can't give way to fear. And that's what the fast bowler's trying to do to you, isn't it? Very hard to be a Christian fast bowler. Violence is your main weapon and tool, terrifying the opposition. It's not very Christian. Mind you, being a spin bowler is about deceit and trickery, which is the art of the devil. Which I suppose means that you really need to be a batsman if you're going to be a Christian cricketer. He comes down and he flings these bumpers right up at the chest cage. You can't give way to fear. I don't think we've seen it always as classically as in a couple of occasions in history, and I'm sorry if you're a bit young and you didn't see these fellas operate, but there was that incredible season some years ago, remember, when Geoff Thompson and Lilly were firing at the Englishman. I was trying to think about it this afternoon, just in preparing here. It was Dennis Amos, wasn't it, who every time he came in was ducking and weaving before he reached the pitch. I mean, as soon as Geoff Taylor came in, he held his bat up just in the hope that somehow something would happen, and it did. He got out. It ended his test career, and it just was terrified. Geoff Thompson was terrifying at that time. Don't get me wrong, Amos was a tad better a batsman than me, or anything like that. But when you're in the stand watching, they're never that good, are they, as we are, you know, I mean. We who are the reserve for the Australian 11. Although, after the last test, I was getting myself ready. I thought there was a chance of a call-up. I mean, why not? But we are always... But, you see, because they were afraid, they couldn't stand. And the whole of the English team just crumpled test after test in that period of time, which I don't know when it would have been, late 60s, early 70s or something like that, wasn't it? But there was another test that I always remember that was back in 1961 with a batsman whom I didn't like at all except in Adelaide in 1961. And that was Slasher Mackay. Slasher Mackay was... The only batsman who batted slower was a man called Trevor Bailey from England. Slasher Mackay was the ultimate all-time slow batsman, wasn't he? He was dreadfully slow. He chewed endlessly, and there was more action in his jaw than there was in his bat, as far as I can remember. But there was that great test in the West Indies series where Wes Hall was operating, and Wes Hall was every bit as fearsome and as awesome as Geoff Taylor and Dennis Lilly. Wes Hall was a fantastically fast, furious batsman, who I may say is a very fine Christian man when he was out here managing the... chat to him about his Christian faith, and he was very kind to her and encouraging her in her Christianity, which is lovely to know about this awesome fast bowler of an earlier generation. Well, in that test, Australia had to hang out for a draw, and if you remember, we had a batsman called Lindsay Klein. The word batsman is a generous expression. Really? He was really a spin bowler. And he was the last man in, and we had about an hour and a half or something like that to bat, and there was Slasher Mackay and Lindsay Klein, and they stuck it out for the last hour, an hour and a half, or 2 hours. I mean, it should have been all over, but they couldn't get them out. And they couldn't get them out because Mackay had guts. He never flinched. He never showed that there was any pain going through his body at all. It was as if his whole head had been cauterized. There was no reflex at all. And I remember seeing the photos in the newspaper the next day, and his shirt off, and there are all these bruises all over his body. But while he was batting, there was never the flinch. He just took the suffering, the pain, all the way to a, unfortunate draw, but to a series victory. We would have lost the series, but for Mackay in that innings. You can't give way to human emotions. Fear, anger, do not work the righteousness of God. Jesus says not to fear men. He said, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Why did he not give way to fear? Well, because he trusted God. And if you trust God, then you do what's right. Do you refuse to speak to me? Pilate said. Don't you realize I have power to either free you or crucify you? Jesus answered, you would have no power over me if it were not given to you from above. He wasn't going to be bullied, even by the man who was going to crucify him. To be a disciple of Jesus is to accept hurt and to not give way to fear. The world will persecute the followers of Jesus, but Jesus said, if anyone wants to be my disciple, he's got to take up his cross and follow me. Jesus doesn't invite men to come and follow him on an easy road and a pleasant way. He says, no, the road is hard. The way is difficult. What you've got to do is accept the persecution and the opposition that will inevitably come because you are following the one who was crucified. You're following me. Hurt is the normal expectation of being a Christian man. And you'll be hurt for no other reason than you are a Christian. And it was because those early disciples took up that challenge that God was with them and enabled them to stand firm under terrible opposition. For the very people who crucified Jesus just 2 months later had a couple of the disciples in front of them and said, you've got to stop talking about this Jesus. And they said, we must obey God rather than men. They threw him in jail. They whipped them, they scourged them. And we read the apostles left the Sanhedrin rejoicing because they had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name of Jesus. Christians know how to hurt because Christians are people who follow the crucified one. What's this taking up the cross? Well, what Jesus did, what he came to do, is to be crucified, to lay down his life to pay for the sins of others. No one took his life from him. He came and laid it down. He could have stopped Pilate then and there. He could have stopped the chief priest then and there. He could have stopped the people who betrayed him. He could have stopped the guards who arrested him. But no, he came to lay down his life. He came to hurt, to be crucified, to be executed, in order to lose his life so that he could save other people. By his death, others live. For the penalty that we all deserve was laid on him, which is why he died our death in our place. He came to do it. Must have taken a fair amount of courage, mustn't it? I mean, part of the reason you can be hurt in football and survive is because you never actually expect it. I mean, the scrum collapses on top of you. You didn't think that when you went into the scrum. It just happens. You don't think about it. If you know that you are going to be hurt when you... It's that fear of what is going to happen to you, which actually wrecks you, doesn't it? Which means you bat like Dennis Amos, which means you do get out. Jesus knew it was going to happen, and yet he still stood firm. Not because he was an unemotional man. This is the man who, beside his friend Lazarus's tomb, wept publicly. But there is a time to weep, and there is a time to stand firm, unflinching. If you're going to be my disciple, he says, you've got to take up your cross and follow me. If you're going to save your life, you've got to lose it. If there's nothing worth dying for, as John Lennon put it, well, then there's nothing worth living for either. If you lose your life for Jesus' sake, why, then you have nothing more to be afraid of. Do not fear those who kill the body but cannot save, but cannot kill the soul. Rather be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. I have nothing to be afraid of what they can do to me. That doesn't mean I'm not going to hurt, but it does mean I'm not going to let the hurt control my behaviour. I'm going to live above the hurt. I'm going to cope with the hurt. I'm going to deal with the hurt, because there is something greater in my life than just my body, than just my pain, than just my suffering. But if you're afraid of other men, then you won't stand for the truth, will you? You won't stand for righteousness. If you're too proud to admit that you need forgiveness, then you'll never receive it. If you're afraid to tell the missus that she was right about God after all, why, you miss out on everything. If you haven't got the guts to face the fellows at work and say, enough is enough, I'm not going to do that anymore, we're not going to practice that way, I'm not going to do those things, I'm not going to take that bit, I'm actually going to live honestly now because I'm changed. If I'm not willing to suffer the costs of God in this world, then I cannot be the disciple of Jesus. If you haven't got the courage to face up to the police or the insurance company or the boss and admit to what you've stolen, admit to what you've cheated and put it right, well, then you are a continued victim of your own crime, aren't you? Because it has dominated you and it continues to dominate you, and you'll always be afraid of the day when one day you're going to be caught out because you didn't have the courage to say, I goofed, I got it wrong, I want to pay it back, I want to put it right. If you can't face your wife and deal with your cheating and adultery, then you're not going to get it right in your own home life, are you? If you can't deal with the hurt, if you can't conquer the hurt, then you remain your own victim, the victim to your own pain. Christ has dealt with all our mistakes, men. Whatever we've done, however bad, however rotten, however much we've been nabled, wrecking up our family, our friends, our neighbours, our job, whatever hurt we have done, Christ has paid for it. And whatever hurt has come upon us in this life, he has borne it. For he has taken upon himself the hurts of the world. And he invites us to take up the cross and follow him. Many men are scared to take up the cross because it sounds like it's going to hurt. And it will. I don't know how it's going to hurt you. I don't know what it means for you, what you will have to do, who you'll have to go and put right about what part of your life. I don't know. It hurts different ones of us differently. I don't know which ones are going to turn their back on you. I mean, one of my dear friends, he'd been an alcoholic for years, and he finally got a month's soberness, and he He went and heard a message like this, and he worked out he needed to become a Christian. And he went home and told his wife, "I've decided to become a Christian." And she said, "That's it. I could live with you as an alcoholic. I can just cope with you as sober. I'll blow it if I'm going to live with you as a Christian." And walked out on him then and there. Took his two kids. We have nothing more to do with him. You don't know how it's going to affect you, do you? I'm not promising you it's not going to hurt. I'm going to promise you that it will hurt. Taking up a cross hurts. But if you take up the cross of Christ, then indeed you get right with God in the first place. Forgiveness comes for the hurt that you've inflicted upon others. And you get liberated from living by avoiding pain. You face up to the real pain of the universe in the victory that Christ has won for us, and can now live in fear of God rather than fear of men. And that liberates you to stand up to whatever they give you. You may be black and blue all over, but your wicked will be intact at the end of the day. This is the way to victory. Crucifixion. To save your life, you must lose it. Just like Jesus, who saved us by losing his life.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.